When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Sovereign Republic. Check out their amazing backpacks at sovereignrepublic.com. I've been personally using their ambassador backpack for all my travels for the last 5 or so years, and it's still as good as new. It's lightweight, stylish, durable, and designed to be carry-on approved for most global airlines. Be sure to use promo code STAYSTOKED for a 15% discount site-wide on their awesome gear. Joining me today from the UK is Katie Hunt. Katie's in the home stretch of her history PhD at the University of Kent. She's also an avid surfer at her home break in North Devon. That is, when the waves are good. At around the age of 21, she began to research surfing outlaws and cowboys, which engendered in her a love for surf history. Currently, she's finishing up her PhD dissertation, as well as presenting conference papers on the ethnologies of minority countercultures in California and New Zealand. So I'm excited that she was able to carve out some time for this interview. For today's episode, we'll be discussing a brief history of the surf shop, as well as giving an overview of its founding years in California. That'll include the early years of California's surf history, which runs from about 1935 to 1959, years some consider to be the golden years of isolated nomadic surf communities. I'm super stoked to have you on to talk about this interesting research. But before we get started, I want to thank you, Katie, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hey, thank you, Jason.
Hey, you bet, Katie. No, super stoked to have you on. You know, let's just go ahead and get into this. You know, being that you're from the UK, you're not, you know, from the US, and but your research is sort of centered around the surf shop, which, you know, it, in that regard, we're talking about California. So I'm just personally curious as to what compelled you to want to study, say, the surf shop in California and not the surf shop phenomenon, you know, back where you're from.
Yeah, I think there's something fascinating about California's deep surf history, the idea of the imagined state versus the reality. And for me, the surf shop story is really where the surf shop, it begins. It's where it's nurtured. And to understand the surf shop and why it's so important to all of us surfers, you really have to go to California's history, back to the outlaw era of the 1950s, and kind of dissect the imagined state from the reality. So California is very much a place that's built around like Hollywood and Disneyland, and sometimes surfing can get distorted in all of that. You can look at the Beach Boys and you see them and you think that's the real surfer identity, that's the real surf culture. And then you look at modern kind of hedonistic lifestyles of like acai bowls on the beach, and you think that's the surf lifestyle. And I wanted to look at California from an outsider perspective and try and break through those imagined identities and work out what the real history is. And I found it fascinating about the surf shop, because to me, that's the space where surfers learn about their culture. You don't really learn about surf culture from the ocean, because you're surfing by yourself. I personally love surfing by myself, so I don't really mix with other surfers or talk about waves or talk about latest products. But to do that, I go to a surf shop and I talk to people in that surf shop, and it becomes a community space. And I think often it's neglected as a space to look at. Often people think surfers beach, and they don't think about the shop, where it's where we buy our stuff and where we hang out the most if we're feeling homesick or we want to get that connection. So yeah, I found it interesting the fact it started in California, and I had a lot of questions as to why it began in California.
Oh no, that's fascinating. And I know you and I were talking, you know, before we really got into the interview, you know, where you're doing your PhD is not at the coast. And one of the things you were telling me is you would go to, you found a surf shop nearby, and you know, you'd go there, and there was something about that atmosphere that really brought you back to the beach. And as you were doing, you know, your research, or as you went into surf shops in California, did you experience that same maybe vibe? I don't know if if that's the word we want to use, but yeah, talk to me a little bit about that, because you know, as you were telling me earlier, I found that fascinating that, you know, way away from the coast, you went into this surf shop and it just kind of brought you back to the beach. So yeah, let's dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm from Devon, which is where you have a big surf scene. You can go down and you'll find like 5 or 6 surf shops in a town, and you can just go into any of them and just strike a conversation. And when I went to university, which is inland, it's got no kind of surf community at all, I felt really homesick. And it was about maybe a month before I had to come up with a PhD idea thesis. And I was like, oh, I'm panicking a little bit. They always say do something that you love. And I'm thinking, what do I love? Well, I love surfing, but that's such a broad topic. And one day when I was really homesick, I went to a surf shop that was about half an hour away, and I didn't even really know it was there because there's no surf community. I don't know how it's there, but I think people travel through to go to France, and then there's a surf community there, so they kind of pick up stuff along their way. So I visited there, and when I walked in, I realized like how much the surf shop meant to me in terms of connecting me to like my identity, and just smelling the surf wax, seeing the surfboards, being able to speak to the people behind the counter and go, oh, I'm from here, where do you surf? And it creates a nice community that you feel accepted and you feel part of. And you just find a little bit of yourself in these spaces. And yeah, I came home and I was like, I know what I'm going to write my PhD on. It's going to be surf shops, because there's something about them. I just can't seem to grasp why, but it makes me feel like who I am. And then I started researching, and that's how I got into surf shops. And then when I went to California, I was a bit worried that if I went into a surf shop, I'd stick out because I'm English and yeah, I might not know the right words. And I walked into a surf shop and immediately I was welcomed with like the same warmth of, oh, what are you doing here? Let's talk about surf spots. And I remember one shop in particular, I was there for 2 hours, which is a long time in a shop. And I think I only bought an earring or something. It was basically nothing, but it was the experience that made it so special, because we were talking about different surf spots for longboards, shortboards. And I just felt like I was with my people again. And even though I was there by myself for 2 months doing research, I made friends from the surf shops, which I probably wouldn't have made at the beach. But I knew that in these spaces, I could just be myself and talk about these things. And yeah, and then I got a few of their numbers and we've been in contact. So it's just such a great place to find people that understand you. And it's interesting as well, because I found some of the surf shops still look like they would have done in the 1950s, or they've even been purposely made to look like they're from the 1950s. And you don't really get that in the UK, because they're much more cleaner, they're much more modern, they've been designed in the last 20 years, whilst you have in California still these old surf ghettos, and you can walk in and it's still that kind of factory style. And I found it fascinating because it was like I was going through a different era of time as I walked through the doors, and I was like, oh, now I can visualize what I was trying to describe in my work. And yeah, so there's some similarities and differences, but I think the main thing is the fact that it makes you feel like you're at home when you go through them, no matter where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of, you know, my friend's surf shop, say in Nicaragua, or going into a surf shop in Bali, or recently in Portugal. There's a certain commonality that we all share, you know, and like you say, you can really get into these conversations. You can talk about your surf trips and sort of bond over this sport, you know, that we all love. And so, again, you've kind of been alluding to your research and all that. And so let's get started on it. Tell me, you know, cause you've talked about the 50s in California and, your research on the surf shop. Let's talk about that. Like, talk to me about the history of the surf shop. Because, you know, I find it fascinating, someone that, you know, as a historian as well of surfing, how it evolved is particularly in California is pretty awesome. And I was, you know, I have to admit, I was looking forward to interviewing you about it because this is your world. So how did you go about doing this research? And, you know, give us a little brief history, if you will, of the surf shop.
Yeah. So it all really begins with a guy called Del Velzi. And he was what's argued as the first owner of the surf shop. It's hard to say what a surf shop is, but if we're looking at a business with a business license that sells surfboards or any kind of surf items, he is the one that is the first. He is the first of many things, such as sponsoring surfers for his shop. And he's a really important character because the most important thing is the fact he never wanted to be the first person to open up a surf shop. And I always find that quite humorous, the fact that he ended up in that position. It was complete accident how it came about. And it's a long list of different things that occurred to create this surf shop that has changed so much over the years. But essentially, it started off with him being at Manhattan Beach Pier after the war. And he decides to start shaping boards. And he shapes boards on the sand, which, as you can guess, balsa wood shavings everywhere, to the point that the police kept chasing him off the beach. They're like, you can't keep carving your surfboards here. I know how much you guys like surfing, but just find a space to do it. And so he ended up going to find a building, which just happened to be just across the road of the pier at 117 Manhattan Beach. And he finds this building that's kind of passed down to him from a family friend, and it's a shoe shop, former shoe shop, repair shop. And he starts to shape his boards in there, and he pays the rent of like $45 a month. And he just starts shaping his boards. He doesn't really call it a shop. He doesn't want people to know it's a shop. There's no signs. There's very small windows. It's literally a little tiny box of a place. You just about have bunk beds, a toilet, and a workstation in the center. And one day a guy in a suit comes along. He looks into the shop and he says, are you selling any goods in here? And he goes, well, yeah, I'm selling goods to my friends, just a few surfboards. And he's like, does that count as a business? And he works out it probably does count as a business. And he says, look, I'm a tax man. You have to go and claim yourself as a business in order to sell any goods. So he basically walked away and he walked down to get a business license. And when he turned up to the State Board of Equalization, he says, I sell surfboards. And they're like, what is that? I've never heard of a surfboard. I don't know what surfing is. He's like, let me explain it all. I carve these boards. And after explaining to all these people, going through a long line of people to work out whether it was a business, they decided, look, I don't care anymore. We're just going to sign this bit of paper and you are formally a business. And he walks back and he continues selling. At no point does he want to make himself recognized as a business. So we still don't see the signs going up. And he creates this clubhouse, which he allows people to sleep over in. It's covered in balsa wood shavings. It's covered in sand. People come in barefoot. And outside in the parking lot, you have surfboards drying and you have barbecues and he holds parties there where they drink beer all day. And it's not a formal shop with a till and a counter and everything else you expect. And that's the first surf shop. Now, this lasts, so this is in the early 1950s, and this lasts as the first surf shop for a couple of years before you start seeing a few more businesses starting to prop up. You've got Huntington Beach, you've got Gordy's Surfboards, you have Hobie's coming up in Orange County, and we start to see more surfboards develop, and they start to take a bit more of a business approach, especially Hobie. He decides, no, I want to make this into a proper industry, and he goes to business school, he learns how to create a business that's going to succeed, and he creates a much more of your kind of modern surf shop, the one that you kind of associate with a surf shop, with a showroom, with a separate factory where all the kind of building work's done for the surfboard. And so we just start to see this development. And after that, you start to see numerous surf shops develop across California. Now, the reason it didn't develop in Hawaii is because they have a completely different culture in terms of surf, creating surfboards. You don't just pop along to a shop and buy a surfboard. It's always been tradition to make your own surfboard, carve it yourself, do the rituals. It's your, you know, rite of passage. You're going, if you're going to surf massive waves, you have to be prepared by doing it yourself, by building the surfboard. And so it doesn't really kick off as a commercial industry in Hawaii, especially because we're dealing with a lot more of political problems as well there at the same time, dealing with racial problems and ownership of sea and land. So California's in the perfect position because it's just finished the war. It's got a big boom in terms of finances, and you've got like World War II's finished, so you've got the technology and the materials. So it was in the perfect time and the perfect place to create a surf shop. And I think that's what makes it a Californian design, because it's essentially part of a bigger local change that's happening, where you're getting more industries and businesses, you're getting the suburbs, you're getting these massive developments in terms of commercialization, and surfing just got swept up in that unintentionally.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, you're talking about post-World War II, which lent itself to the modernization of surfing, surfboards, some of the technologies that come out of the war, neoprene and other things. It was, like you said, it sort of all came together and created this boom. And California provided sort of the perfect, let's say, breeding ground for that. You know, it's funny when you were talking about Velzy carving, you know, surfboards on the beach. It reminded me of the movie Big Wednesday, where, you know, one of the characters is shaping boards on the pier. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a great visual to imagine these guys, you know, in the 50s and maybe even the 60s doing, you know, sort of bringing this surf shop idea into fruition. And so, you know, thank you, by the way, for that history. It's fascinating. Would you mind, you know, because you've mentioned Hobie, you've mentioned Velzy, you've mentioned a number of individuals that eventually went on to shape and start surf shops. Could you describe, you know, some of the surf shops? Like, what did they look like back then? I know you said Velzy's shaping shop was this little box, essentially. But once they evolved into a more formal, we'll call it a surf shop, what did they look like?
Yeah. So when we look at Velzy's, his is, you kind of have two different styles of surf shops. And that continues until about the late 60s, when the ones that didn't adapt started to eventually become bankrupt, including Velzy himself. So when we're looking at the 50s and the 60s, you start to notice you either have the garage surf shops or you have the modern surf shops. And they can look completely different. So the garage surf shops is very much a space where it's mainly focusing on encouraging people to shape. It's got often a lot of Grammys and children watching the shapers, learning from these people, missing school, skipping school, going to watch these shapers shape all day and providing assistance. Like, they would sweep the floor, they would sometimes do the worst jobs, such as glass, like doing the glassing of the surfboards. And you start to see this place is mainly a clubhouse where you've got no shoes on. Whilst if we look at Hobie's, his was very interesting because he laid it out to fit more of a McDonald's type of place. That's how I refer to it, as like a 19, what you'd imagine a 1950s commercial outlet would look like. It's called the Googie style of architecture, which is completely different to this garage. So you imagine a garage where everything's in one room, including the toilet, the bunk beds, you know, it's all in one space. Whilst you have this more of a commercial space, which looks like at the time the drive-throughs that you would see starting to pop up. And the reason for this is because at the end of the war, you want to separate the past with the future. And especially with winning the war, there's a sense of let's show our power. And to do that, they use the nuclear age and the space and the atomic age. And you can see that through the architecture. So Hobie's had a lot of angled shapes. He had angled shapes on the outside of the building, on his signs, a big triangle, basically pointing, going, this is my shop. And it was positioned on the Pacific Coast Highway, whilst other surf shops such as Velzy was positioned by the pier, purposely near the beach. Whilst Hobie decided, no, I want to be near the highway because I will attract a lot of people passing through. And in order to attract people at the time, you didn't have massive television screens saying, oh, this is some shops or advertising surfboards. Instead, you had these architecture to rely on. And the Googie style of architecture was made specifically to attract people on the road because it had, well, what they say is shapes of movement. So they had boomerangs and atomic symbols. And this attracted people to pull into large parking lots, which you didn't have near the beach. And so people could just pull off the highway, especially in places that were quite quiet. If you're driving for a long time and you want a break, you're going to stop at a nearby parking lot. And Hobie chose his in Dana Point because he knew it was quiet and he knew people were going to stop there. So he had all this modern architecture to attract people to stop there. And when you went in, you had a showroom, which was really important because that's quite a modern surf shop. You had the surfboards all lined up against these large windows, letting in natural light. So you can see straight in, oh, that's a surfboard. Oh, you know, that's the different types compared to Velzy's, which are small windows, very dark rooms. And not only that, but you had a separate station for where you build the surfboards. You'd have slots in the ground so you could put the workhorse into the slot so it wasn't wobbling around. You had it constantly cleaned, which Velzy really didn't do. There's always shavings in his place, but Hobie always kept his nice and clean. It was always looking very professional. And everything was very separate so that if you went in, you knew where the surfboards were. You weren't looking at the process of the surfboard being made. And importantly, Hobie also had a telephone line, which was good because he was able to send out orders far and wide across the nation. He invented the idea of the fin being removed so that he could detach the fin and then it could be boxed up and sent without ruining the board. So there's multiple ways that Hobie made his surf shop open to everyone. He wanted to attract everyone. He wanted everyone to have an escapist moment where they could become a surfer, even if they didn't surf. And he was very much like encouraging people to take up the sport and to witness his lifestyle, because in his mindset, that is the best lifestyle. And he too didn't wear shoes. He too refused to wear a suit. So although it's very easy to compare the two and be like, oh, they're completely different, they're still the same people that grew up on the beach, grew up surfing. But just one had more of a business brain, whilst Velzy had more of a, I just want to make what I enjoy. And if people don't want to buy it, that's fine. If people want to buy it, that's fine. I don't care. And you can see that in his sales techniques as well. He's definitely a very rogue character in terms of how he sells his surfboards. He would have people coming in asking for custom surfboards, and he would be too busy creating his own designs, he'll completely forget until they show up. And he'll be like, oh, no, I haven't got your surfboard. But he won't say that to them because he never wanted to say that he was defeated and he was a bad shaper. So he'd get a surfboard out from the rack and he'll ask them to hold one end of the measuring tape usually the end that's just a little bit of clip. And then he'll pull it up. He'll look at the number and be like, oh, it's perfect. See, it's exactly the number you wanted. And he'll do like a sleight of hand trick, a bit of a magician trick where he won't show them the number. He'll completely put the tape back together and then be like, yep, that's your surfboard. I knew I had it somewhere. And then off they go. He didn't really care about the fact that he might have been lying or been a bit cheeky about how he sold his surfboards. But at the end of the day, he just wanted to practice his shaping techniques, creating his surfboards. He didn't really care about the customer, which is completely different to Hobie.
Yeah, no, it sounds like, you know, a couple of things. One, the modern surf shop, let's say, seems to more closely emulate Hobie's understanding of, or Hobie's surf shop style, let's say. And the vibe that, you know, we were talking about earlier, like that you experienced when you went into that surf shop that was even off the coast, that experience that one, the feeling one gets when they walk into a surf shop, that seems to me kind of, based on what you were saying, falls more in line with what Hobie wanted to create as a surf shop, as an experience. Okay, so we've talked about, you know, Hobie's surf shop and Velzy's surf shop. Did you get an opportunity to go visit them? Are they still standing today? And I asked for the listeners around the world that, you know, may or may not get to go to California.
Yeah, so unfortunately, both of their first shops have been changed. For Hobie's, it's now been demolished, but Velzy's is still standing. If you ever go to Manhattan Beach Pier, it's currently a restaurant, but they, I believe, have a sign now that's up that's honoring him. They've been working hard to put it up to say that it's the first surf shop and mentioning his name. But what's really interesting at the Shack, or the Surfing Heritage Cultural Center, they have a replica of Dale Velzy's pier shop. So not the one that is actually his garage, but the one that he was kicked off the beach for, which is his little... a little hut that he would carve his boards from and get all over the sand. But it actually has the replica items of what he would have had shaping at that time. So although it's not the original, it was definitely an experience to go and see it, just to see what it would have been like to be at the beach carving these surfboards. And you can see his shaping tools, his hat. I think there's a set of bongos as well, which often, that I don't know why, but they often appear in his stories, like when he became bankrupt later on. They keep mentioning the fact that his bongos were left behind, and it was a really sad story. So you can see all these items that have been left that meant a lot to him. And you can see that it was a very like a raw business, a rough business. There was nothing very clean about it, but it had so much personality looking at it. It's his way of life. And you can see the passion through the items that were left behind. It wasn't many items, but he managed to make this business out of basically nothing from this tiny little shed. And then when you actually look at the surf shops, Velzy did have multiple shops, and you can still see the San Clemente one on the main Pacific Coast Highway. And if you pass by it, that is where the Bruce Brown film Slippery When Wet was filmed. And you can still see the exterior of the shop, which hasn't changed at all. So that's really interesting to see. You can stand there and you can walk down to the beach and see the path that Velzy would have taken, where his truck would have been parked. So that's still standing, and it still looks very similar. There hasn't been many changes to it. And so, yeah, it's quite interesting to see how it's still very small, though, and the windows were still really small. So even though he developed and got more shops over the years, they still had the very same architecture that he had in the first one, having a very small garage-sized space with limited light, because he enjoyed just crafting. Whilst Hobie's, if you look at Hobie's shops as they expanded over Orange County, I visited a few of those, and you can still see the like professionalism of them, the big windows. Although now it's changed more into clothing rather than surfboards, you could definitely still see the styles and how Hobie's always gone for larger spaces and taller spaces. So just being in those spaces, you can just feel the difference and recognize the location differences as well.
Oh no, it's awesome. It, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, I'm listening to you describe, you know, these places in California, and I used to live in Southern California. So, you know, as the way you describe it, it's almost as if, you know, you have this very unique outsider appreciation for these spaces, these places where, you know, the surfers of the 50s and 60s used to paddle out. Do you, you know, in your experience there, you know, cruising around California, going into the surf shops, probably talking to all the surf shop folks about, you know, your research, as did, you know, as do I, do you feel that they have like a similar appreciation, or could they put their finger on that, you know, Hobie Surf Shop or Velzy Surf Shop? So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, as an outsider, do you feel like you had a different appreciation for it, or appreciation whereas others, locals, didn't have? Or what was that experience like?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I haven't really thought about the perspective, but it's true, because when I went there, I often went, I think there's the surf ghetto in San Clemente, and this is like where the old surf shops are, where some of the oldest factories are. And I remember walking into them thinking, I'm going to get so much knowledge here for my research. They're going to be talking to me all about these surf shops and these big names and how exciting. And you walk in and I go, oh, is that like an old Velzy board on the ceiling? And they're like, who? I'm like, oh, like I realized very quickly that people didn't get that excited about surf history as I did. And they didn't realize, to them, it's just a job, which is understandable. They were surfers and they enjoy working in a surf shop, but they didn't have the same, I'm working in a Hobie's. This has been since 1950s. This has such a rich history. And I did feel a bit like that the surf shop story had kind of been lost as just a commercial outlet, which is going against my dissertation in some ways, because of my thesis is looking at the fact that it's a very cultural space, and it still is a cultural space, but it's lost that connection to the past and how it was made and the characters that they're representing. But I found it interesting as well to talk a bit about the history as well and be like, oh, did you know this spot here is this shop or whatever? And I would just speak to them, and I was managed to bring it back out. But I think, yeah, you're right. A lot of people maybe don't appreciate the fact that there's history right on your street. There's history right there. And I don't think many people knew that Velzy's shop in San Clemente was right on this main road, because people walk by it every day and it probably doesn't mean anything to a lot of people. But for surfers, this is a really important place. And I enjoyed posting photos and finding photos and comparison of photos of this is from the past, this was taken in the 1950s, and then this is taken today, and exploring how much has changed or how little has changed, and bringing these spaces back to life through the history.
Yeah, you know, I love the work you're doing. I think it's amazing. And, you know, you're right, though, like, in many cases, the folks that you're chatting with, and you guys are probably having amazing conversations, you know, in these surf shops, but, you know, at the end of the day, they love surfing, and they, you know, probably are stoked to work at the surf shop, but they don't, you know, they didn't get like a you know, sort of a history lesson, if you will, of the deep and rich history that is California surf culture. You know, it's funny. I'm interested to hear how you went about doing this research, because, you know, you mentioned you got excited to go into surf shops thinking everyone was going to be a wealth of knowledge, and, you know, it didn't turn out that way. So I'm actually interested to know, you know, how you went about digging into this. And I'll just add something funny, you know, about the surf shop. Like, when I was doing my research, and when I was, you know, teaching a history of surfing class, I was in Haleiwa, right on the north shore of Oahu. And, you know, I myself, like you, you know, I was probably talking this guy's ear off about surfing history. And in that case, I was talking about Duke Kahanamoku. And he's like, oh, man, have you seen the movie Waterman? And I was like, no, I hadn't. And so I guess the reason I'm saying that is there are those little nuggets and those anomaly occasions where the people working at the surf shop are really just die hard into the history as well. And you know, I think they're few and far between. But, you know, I remember that moment very vividly. And I was like, I went and watched that movie, and I was like, how come I never saw this movie? It's a great movie. But anyways, you know, kind of back to you, visiting the surf shops didn't necessarily pan out as that wealth of knowledge you were looking for. Where did you go to get this information? You know, What did you use archivally to write
this? This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Dissertation.
Just to kind of bounce off what you just said as well, it's quite interesting the fact that I don't really know much about my local surf history. You can ask me anything about British surf history, and I will know very little, because you just, like you said, you get used to being in an environment. You just get used to, oh, that's the way it is. That's that there. And if I worked in a surf shop in England, I would probably hate it. If I had someone come and go, tell me the history of surf shops in England, I'd be like, oh, I haven't studied this. Or so, yeah, it's definitely something that it happens if you're in your local area that you often don't research it as much as something that may interest you because it's exotic elsewhere. And that's what I found here. But archives, I did find, so I think it's Patterson's surf shop in San Clemente. And I'd gone through literally a list. I was given a list by the shack, and they told me, here's some surf shops, different types of surf shops, check them out. And so I went out because I can't drive, and I was walking for miles and miles, and it was very hot, something I'm not used to being from England. And I was walking to all these surf shops, and I was getting a bit down at the fact that not many knew the history. And I went to Patterson's, and I walked in, and there's just photographs all over the walls of, you got Velzy, you got Hobie, you got Noel. And I was like, this is amazing. And I was worried that if I spoke to the person in the shop, they'd be like, oh, it's just some photos. But they're like, oh, come into the back room. And I was like, okay. And then there was just photo albums after photo albums. And I was like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I needed. And not only did it show the individual surf shop owners, but it also showed them interacting with each other, which I think has often been missed in surf history. Surf history tends to look at a certain place or a certain person. You get a lot of autobiographies, and you don't really get a comparison in a positive light of, oh, Hobie and Velzy were actually friends, or Noel and Velzy worked together and things like this. It's often very separated. And to see in the photo albums them interacting and the positive vibes coming off them, it changed how I saw them, and it made them a lot more human being able to access these archives. And I found that really fascinating to me, even though I can't necessarily put what like the photos into the thesis, I can definitely just absorb that knowledge of the camaraderie and the community friendship. And after I went to that shop, I started to see it from a different perspective of, instead of kind of interrogating people, me like, what do you know about your shop? Instead asking them, why do they like the surf shop? And hearing their story and their connection to it, because that in a way also links to history and does help enrich my knowledge of the place. And then I started to get some really interesting feedback. I can't remember the name of the shop, but in San Clemente, I visited one, and they showed me that they had splodges of resin on the floor. And I was like, well, why is this on the floor? Like, this is really interesting to me, because it's a very modern shop. It's been built recently. It's a closed shop as well. It's not as if a surfboard's been made here. And they said that they purposely did that during the architecture because they wanted to replicate the old-fashioned factories. And I was like, that's so interesting. Like, you probably wouldn't notice if you went to a shop. You wouldn't look at the floor and go, I wonder why this is here. And the fact they brought that up and showed it to me and explained that they wanted to create this old-fashioned 1950s architecture made me realize the fact that there is this nostalgia for the surf shop. And even if you don't know the exact facts, you still know the fact that there's something nice about a shared space that can be a workshop and a garage. And even as a clothes retail shop, they're trying to replicate this old-fashioned garage-style Velzy space, even without realizing perhaps who did it, but they wanted to connect to it. And I find that fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that you know, being in Southern California, you do feel that, you know, surf history in a sense. And, you know, you keep mentioning Shaq. And obviously I know exactly what you're talking about. But for our listeners, would you mind just explaining a little bit about the Surf Hulk Heritage and Cultural Center? Like, you know, because some, you know, listeners probably hear shag. Oh, she's talking about, you know, getting shag, getting barreled or whatever. But, you know, but like I said, I know what you're talking about. But shag is this, you know, I was there doing archival research as well. But would you mind just explaining what it is briefly?
Yeah. So the Surfing Heritage and Culture Center, it's a space where they have a large collections of surf history, especially artifacts, which is something that you can't get your hands on if you're not there in person. And that's what's really beneficial for people like me, that you can read as much as you like, you can access interviews online, but to actually see these artifacts is really special, because when you actually see a surfboard right in front of you, see the size, see the thickness, see the material, that's when you actually understand what it would have felt like in the past, what it would have been like to handle these objects. And so the Surfing Heritage and Cultural Center is one of several archives that I visited whilst in California. So I visited there, the California Surf Museum and the Huntington Beach International Surf Museum, all very similar in the layout and what they have. They tend to have an archive area filled with special collections and books. But then they got the main showrooms of surfboards, objects such as letters or shoes, hats, all different types of things. And so it's a very interactive and interesting archives, because you don't really get that in many places when you're looking at history. It's not like you go down into the basement and you're going through all these bookshelves and trying to scroll through. Instead, it's very light and filled with things that you can touch and see, and it's very visually exciting. And so, yeah, these three archives are really important for me to visualize what I was writing about and be able to place myself in that time.
Yeah, no, I agree, you know, and I remember being at the Surfing Heritage and Culture Center, just sitting in that room with all the surfing magazines. And I'm like, I would have never thought as a little kid that these would become archives, right? That I would be using these magazines to write a dissertation or to conduct research. So, you know, I have to admit, I was almost like giddy in there, because it was, you know, bringing back so many memories, like flipping through the magazines and seeing like old punk rock bands when they were just getting started out, and you know, even chatting with the director and some of the people there, it was a blast. But you know, I want to come back to something that you mentioned, and you know, obviously this is an audio, not a video, but you know, for the listeners, she's wearing a Hobie sweatshirt. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, you mentioned Greg Knoll, and I think you mentioned even Bruce Brown and some of these guys. And you mentioned Dana Point, but I think a lot of these guys made up what was called the Dana Point Mafia. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. So Dana Point Mafia is a group of people that essentially made the surf culture in Orange County in Southern California. So we have, obviously, you've got Malibu, which is a big hotspot. You've got Mickey Dora, you have Velzy up there as well at certain points. And they're already creating a surf community there. But Southern California has been a bit neglected by that culture. And you start to see a bit more affluent individuals such as Hobie, who's had a good education, who's been to holiday homes to Southern California. So perhaps not a local, but has visited enough times to create friends and a community there. But he starts to develop Dana Point specifically during the 1950s. And they create, from this tiny little hub, the entirety of Southern California's surf culture. And you start to see Hobie's shop open up, which is where you get your surfboards from. It's right near to Killer Dana, so important surf areas, Doheny, and places like that. And then you start to have people like John Severson creating Surfer Magazine at Dana Point. And this is a massive shift in the traditional surf culture, because you start to have it written down. People start to see themselves and be represented in the press and be able to collect these magazines. And the magazines are basically a Bible where they can tell people what a surf culture is about and create this community even from afar. And people know that it comes from Southern California. And you can see in these magazines, they talk about spaces around the local areas, linking them up to surf shops. So everybody kind of develops this modern surf culture from Dana Point. And Dana Point becomes this kind of a magical place where you've got films being made by Bruce Brown, you've got magazines by John Severson, you've got Hobie creating surfboards, you've got Phil Edwards put there, the Hoffman brothers, all of them have their own skills and they're adding to the culture. And so therefore this Dana Point, they're called the Mafia, especially by Mickey Dora, who doesn't really like them. And I mean, unsurprisingly, anyone that meddles with commercialism and surfing, he dislikes. But he sees them as basically running the surf culture from this tiny location. And it's interesting because Dana Point starts off as an agricultural place with very little populace. It's a ends up being a middle-class area for a bit. And then you see it develop into an harbor, which removes the surfing from Killer Dana. And you see these developments, yet even with this external changes in the environment, surfing is still a major hub there. And you still see their statues along the Pacific Coast Highway honoring these mafia members because of what they've done for surf culture, all from this one space. And I think it was Dick Metz states that he really did control the industry there. The mafia controlled the surf culture just from this one location. And it just happened to have all these creative and inspirational people in one space that could create a new modern surf culture, which the other spaces didn't do. You had Malibu sticking to the traditional one of nomadic lifestyle, of aggression, localism. And then you have Dana Point, which is inclusive. It's saying, come along, try out the sport. We're going to make polyurethane boards, we're going to foam boards for everyone. And these technological advances were to help people rather than hinder them. They wanted tourism. And in some ways, they brought surf culture to the forefront and showed it to the nation and brought it to public consciousness in a mass of different medias of visual, audio, all these different ways. And that's really where surf culture spreads and becomes known in England, in Australia. It's all starting from this one little town.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny, you know, you mentioned Mickey Dora, and I think Matt Warshaw in The History of Surfing, that subchapter he titles like the anti-hero or something. And, you know, we were talking before, but, you know, Mickey Dora, I think in the 60s was complaining that Malibu was getting crowded, you know, and he'd be rolling over in his grave to see what Malibu looks like today. But yeah, thank you for that explanation of the Dana Point Mafia. And I mean, let's face it, like they really were instrumental in sort of crafting you know, surf culture. I mean, Surfer Magazine, like we said, I mean, that is, you know, you referenced, you know, those magazines is like the Bible, you know, it's these, you know, they were sort of a tangible way of looking at and documenting surf culture. Bruce Brown's obviously, you know, goes without saying the Endless Summer movie, but all the other movies that these guys were making as well. And so, yeah, it really is fascinating to think that all of that culture was emanating out of that one little area. And so, you know, you mentioned something as you were talking, you were talking about like this nomadic surf culture. You know, what do you mean by that? Was what about this era, let's say early California surf culture, let's call it, was nomadic? Like, where would we have seen that sort of, you know, that sort of behavior, let's say?
So prior to World War II, you have predominantly surf clubs ruling the beaches. And you see a lot of order. The surf clubs themselves had a lot of rules that you had to follow. For example, initiation, you'd wear a suit. I think it's Doc Bull's surf club where he had a set of shark teeth with a list of rules that included things such as trying not to smoke, not drinking, and you had to show up and wear your shoes and be responsible out in the water. And there's it seems very much like any other sport at the time. It's very controlled. And as the war happens, these men are sent off to a fight. And therefore the beaches become open spaces to people that perhaps weren't good enough for the clubs or didn't want to follow any rules. And you start to see people like Velzy taking over these empty shores. And eventually when they get caught up to war, which is further down on the line of like 1944, 1945, they experience living life on the beaches in Hawaii, or they're spending a lot of time on ships in the Navy, and they enjoy sleeping outside, watching the stars. And when they return back to California, there's a nostalgia for their wartime days. And with the GI Bill, it means that they don't have to work anymore because they're getting paid a set amount each month. They're getting an allowance, which basically allows them to have a part-time job and sleep on the beach. They don't need a house. Who says you need a house? If they can afford to get some food, afford some alcohol, to afford some wood to make surfboards, that's all they really needed. And they decided to become lifeguards on part-time or maybe work in a local restaurant. But Velzy was one of the people that really initiated this nomadic lifestyle of just sleeping on the beach, having no order, no control, no policing. And in Manhattan Beach, you then start getting these grummies coming along. So you have Greg Knoll and Hap Jacobs, and they join along and they start to grow up in this lifestyle as well. They start skipping school, they start hanging out around the beach, and you start to see this new culture coming along that's saying you don't need responsibilities, you just need surfing. Surfing is a way of life. It's not just a hobby, it's not just a club, it's who you are. And being on the beach 24/7 is the best way for a surfer. And this develops not only at Manhattan Beach, but you see it as well in La Jolla, down in San Diego, and you'll see it in Malibu. And you have these little pockets of surfers that refuse to have a mortgage, refuse to live in a house, refuse to wear a suit and go to a job. They refuse shoes most of the time. And they decide to live this nomadic lifestyle. Mickey Dore is definitely an example of this. And being on Malibu, he is the king of the waves. And if he doesn't like someone, he'll just push them off. And you'll find that if a tourist comes along wearing shoes or has sunburn and they don't know how to look after themselves at the beach, he'll steal their sandwiches, he'll scare them off. And that's the lifestyle that was going on. And then in parallel, you have the Hobie lifestyle, which is basically saying anyone could come along and surf, come to my shop. And so you have these two very different, and I referred to them as the nomadic lifestyle, and then you have the more organized, modern, come along and join the sport. And I think the difference being is their backgrounds, is the fact that people like Velzy and Mickey Dore, they didn't have the easiest upbringings. Often they came from working class families or perhaps broken homes. And they found surfing as their solace. They found the beach a place where they could relax, find themselves. And they didn't have that at school. They didn't have that at home. Whilst people such as Hobie and the Dana Point Mafia, they had a good education, they went to school, they had a good house, they had holiday homes. And therefore, these different lifestyles meant they had different ideas about where the surf culture was aiming and where they wanted to take it. One was set in the past, one was set in the future. And you can see this with like Mickey Dore. He would wear cowboy clothes, he will dress like people from the history, because he watched a lot of cowboy programs growing up as a child. And to him, the Wild West and that, you know, living on a ranch, that was the life he wanted. Whilst Hobie grew up watching Mickey Mouse, and he wanted to live that Disneyland kind of ideology. So just having these two different backgrounds meant surfing was being divided into two different cultures. And both of them were trying to argue with each other, which is the best route, which one will allow surfing to thrive. And they just had different ethoses about which one was the surfer way of life.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, I have so many more questions for you, but, you know, we'll go ahead and bring this to a close. Katie, you know, thank you so much. Thank you for doing this research and this work. I mean, I think it's awesome to, you know, have somebody who's, you know, like you said, from England, doing this research that's in the U.S. And I just think you offer this a fresh perspective on something that many of us, I would say, take for granted. And so, you know, thank you very much for doing that. And Katie, with that, I'm going to go ahead and give you the last word.
No worries. I really appreciate you having me on here, being able to talk about surf shops. And I really hope that people are more aware about their environments and appreciative of the roots of these shops and how these places nurtured and formulated the surf culture that we love spreading and talking about. And yeah, I'd love to bring this history to life, and I really appreciate being on here.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Katie about the history of the surf shop and early California surf history, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I interview Dr. Chad Nelson, the CEO of the Surfrider Foundation. He and I'll chat about some of the threats our oceans and coast face, as well as the important role surfers and surfing can play in conservation. If this topic gets you stoked, then this will certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Sovereign Republic again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at sovereignrepublic.com, and while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.